is out on the edge of darkness. There rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again.
This is Peace Talks, a series of programs highlighting peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. While Yousef Islam, formerly known as Cat Stevens, sings about the peace train, travel isn't always a peaceful experience, whether on a bus, train, plane, or automobile.
You know, change lanes, cut in front of people. I mean, my friend, her husband was an 18-wheeler truck driver. She said, I don't know who that man is when he gets behind the wheel.
You know, on the plane, like, we had a rowdy plane because they were drinking excessively. So when people were trying to sleep on the plane, of course, they were rowdy and loud. So it's like, when is there time for people to say, no, you can't drink anymore because you're getting out of hand?
I think people are very impatient nowadays. They don't want to be questioned about anything. They don't want to be asked any questions. They want to get on and go where they're going and get where they're going.
We've heard the terms road rage, air rage, and line rage. Whatever you call it, when people travel, our patience is tested, conflicts arise, and keeping peace within a traveling community can be a challenge. Today on Peace Talks, a discussion on tempering travel rage. I'm Suzanne Kreider. According to the U.S. Bureau of Transportation Statistics for 2001, Americans traveled over 500 million air miles and over 4 billion highway miles. But how many of those miles were peaceful? Today on Peace Talks, we'll explore the causes of travel rage and specific ways to prevent or at least control it. Our two guests will help us learn to stay calm as we co-create traveling communities with our fellow voyagers. Later, we'll talk with Diana Fairchild, an aviation health and safety author. She was an international flight attendant for 21 years. Our first guest is Dr. Leon James, expert and author on road rage, who is also a professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. Welcome, Dr. James.
Thank you, and aloha from Hawaii.
You're the co-author of a book titled Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. What's the difference between those two terms?
It's a question of intensity, often used that way by police, but there isn't an official difference. Generally speaking, road rage is more intense and has two meanings, one which is external or overt, and that's assault and battery. But psychologically, road rage involves the emotion of wanting to commit assault and battery. So the inside is much more common than the outside.
And how does that relate to aggressive driving?
Well, aggressive driving is basically a cultural norm. It's something that our culture has evolved, although this is also the case in Europe and other places where they have exactly the same problem. So it's a natural evolution where people begin to compete and act aggressively with each other. And especially in driving, this is a dangerous thing because at any moment a crash can occur or something usually unexpected.
And talk about what you mean by the natural evolution of a cultural norm. When did all this start?
Actually, the backseat of the car is the road rage nursery because that's when children begin to absorb how drivers are acting, are supposed to act, the role models that they are exposed to, and also how the car, whether it goes fast or slow or abruptly goes around turns, these are physiological conditioning effects that we have very early as children. And so when we begin to drive, we seek that kind of feeling or sensation again because that's what feels normal.
But are you saying that if my parents didn't drive that way, I would never develop aggressive driving instincts?
Well, yes, that's correct. Although besides the parents, you also have other adults and also the media, which are very influential.
How do the media influence us?
Well, children are exposed to many scenes in the course of an evening that portray drivers behaving badly. My students watch television once, and this is one of their favorite reports, and they developed a scale they call DBB, drivers behaving badly. And it was very easy to watch an evening and to record many scenes where this is happening. And once this is children are exposed to this, then as adults, again, it's something familiar and natural that we fall into.
And in addition to these psychological or conditioned patterns, aren't there also predisposing conditions, for example, rush hour on Friday?
Yes, that's correct. And there's some situations we give ourselves permission to express more anger than on other situations. And again, these are norms that we pick up when we are socialized as drivers.
Yeah, and when you talk about permission to express anger, I read of one story where two drivers were so angry at each other and displaying aggressive driving behavior, one pulled over and then another one pulled over. They started running towards each other. Then they realized that they were neighbors and they just stopped dead in their tracks. It seems like that tells us that a lot of our rude behavior is due to anonymity.
Yes, that's partially true, especially if you contrast it with line rage, which is much rarer, but also sort of occurs now, and also travel rage generally, where people explode at just anybody who's around who happens to be an employee. So I think the norms for giving ourselves permission to explode have broadened.
This is Peace Talks. We're talking with Dr. Leon James, professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii and author of the book Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. So you suggest that many of those 42,000 traffic fatalities that occur every year in the United States are a result of driver error that can be traced back to emotional intelligence or the lack of emotional intelligence. What do you mean by emotional intelligence?
Emotional intelligence refers specifically to a driver's ability to talk themselves out of doing something that's risky or unadvisable. So in other words, they foresee and the consequences of what they're going to do, and they have the motivation to keep themselves from doing what they feel like doing and rather to follow these more rational principles. So this is emotional intelligence as a driver.
Well, Dr. James, talk us through that. What would you say to yourself if somebody did something that was unadvisable or risky in front of your car?
Well, an example would be, you can say, they're so stupid for doing this, which is something very common, or they make me so angry when they do this, versus the other model, more emotionally intelligent model, would be, I get so upset when they do this. This focuses on the self, and so now I have a choice to do something about it. I can ask myself, being upset, does that help me deal with the situation? And that kind of thing leads you to more emotional, intelligent alternatives.
How do you stop yourself, though? Because I can sense myself, I'm getting really angry, somebody just slammed their brakes on in front of me. How do I make that choice between they're so stupid versus I get so upset?
Yes. You have to be committed, first of all. In our Road Rage book, we have a three-step program that really works for everybody, and it's the AWM, Acknowledge, Witness, Modify. And the first step is difficult. Acknowledge, it means that you have to face it. Yes, I do have these emotions. I do have road rage, even though I don't have a ticket and I never got into any fight with anybody. I still have road rage, and I'm aggressive, and I have these emotions. So that's the first step. It's very difficult, I found, that for a lot of people to make that first step. And then the second step is you've got to witness yourself. You've got to be a witness to yourself when you drive. You sort of split your mind into two, one that observes, the other that's driving. And then you begin to discover that you're not such a good driver as you think, and also you begin to discover when you get hot under the collar, so you begin to anticipate in advance, and so you have more warning what to do about it. And then the last step is modify. And so on any one trip, you can pick one thing to work on, to focus on, and whether it's emotional or whether it's outward behavioral, like following too close, or whether getting mad when somebody tries to get in, or closing the gap when somebody wants to get in ahead of me. So you begin to work with each of these and become more rational. One of the things that I recommend when you suddenly feel that you're going to explode is to make funny noises.
Like what?
It could be animal noises, or it could just be just strange noises. Anything at all that requires a lot of energy. Some people say, oh, you don't have to make noises, but you can control your breathing or start breathing in a certain way. But whatever you do, it has to do with your breathing. So during the first 10 seconds, just before you're going to explode, you need to control that in any way you can, and breathing is important. And also you need to watch, for instance, your hands, whether they tighten around the wheel. So you try to relax the hands. So you relax the hands and you make funny noises, and that takes care of the first few seconds. By the time 10 seconds have gone by, that adrenaline is much less intense, and then you are able to give yourself a pep talk, and you have to be able to be prepared with your philosophy, your new philosophy of driving.
That's fascinating to me, because when you talk about making funny noises, I see myself in a car, and it's like a self-enclosed capsule, because most of my driving is by myself. For example, you wouldn't give that tip if somebody was in an airplane. So talk about how a car is really an enclosed capsule that makes us feel separate or invincible. I guess this gets back to driver anonymity.
Yes, driver anonymity is a key concept, and also driver alienation, and the two go together because when you are enclosed in your capsule all by yourself, you have also opportunity to become alienated, so that you begin to think negatively about all the drivers around you. So therefore, we no longer have a highway community, but we have a warfare going on. For instance, one of the reasons I don't like dark tinted windows, because you can't see the other driver. You have no idea what's going on. What is that driver doing? Are they looking at me? Are they not? Are they looking ahead? There's a certain type of information that makes us more comfortable knowing about the other car, so that we don't feel alienated. But that's not a good feeling isolated, because driving in reality is a cooperative process. A lot of coordination is required between the drivers. And if there's a failure anywhere in this cooperation, there's a crash. So rather than trying to feel isolated, I think what we need to do is bring drivers more into coordination with each other and awareness of each other.
In this cooperative driving community, sometimes, you know, we make mistakes inadvertently. Like sometimes I'll move over into a lane and then I'll suddenly look up and realize there's somebody right behind me. What do you recommend when somebody makes a mistake? Is there some way that we can apologize? I read that we should all carry a sign that reads, "I'm sorry."
Yes. In fact, I've seen commercial versions of this where they sell the cards, or else lights in the back of the car that you can flash the sign, "I'm sorry." For instance, the National Motorists Association has various recommendations for how to say sorry, or other such warning signs, other signs like warning and so on. But the problem has always been that visibility is not so good between drivers, and also because drivers misuse gesturing to each other for insulting each other. So that's why I've always been, you know, sort of lukewarm about developing communication systems within cars that have to do with hand gestures.
And let's talk a little bit about prevention. Can road rage be effectively addressed in driver's education classes, or is it so deeply conditioned that we can't train people out of it?
Yes, we can. I think this is the most important method that we have for dealing with road rage. We now have a video that I wrote. It's called Road Rages, and it has affective objectives. And these affective objectives is really what we need in driver education. And in our book, we actually recommend a new program called Lifelong Driver Education. Now, it's never been implemented, but I think theoretically it still makes sense to me. And that is that you start when we are first exposed to driving attitudes. And that is in infancy, as we are being driven around by adults. So we have an affective component for the early education years. Then we have a cognitive component for the middle years. And and then finally a sensory motor component for the high school years. And then after they get the license, we have a what we call quality driving circles, which is a lifelong participation in driver self-improvement programs.
And Dr. James, if you had 1 minute to summarize the best tips for prevention and handling feelings of anger or frustration while driving, what would those be?
Well, one simple rule is to give yourself more time, to count the time that you're driving as part of your trip. Give yourself more time, in other words. So you have to figure in for at least, let's say, 20% extra, which it could take, so you're not as anxious. But it's not easy to do that. But anyway, it is very effective. And another one is to keep a driving diary so that when you arrive at some place, take a few minutes to write down your thoughts and feelings and your reflections. And then over time, as you look in this diary, you can get to know yourself as a driver, and you have a chance to change yourself.
Great. And would you be willing to give out your website?
Yes, that's a good idea. I have selections of the book there and lots of good articles and statistical information. And it's drdriving.org, D-R-D-R-I-V-I-N-G, drdriving.org.
Dr. Leon James, professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii, thanks so much for being our guest.
You're welcome, and aloha from Hawaii.
This is Peace Talks. We're having a discussion today on tempering travel rage. We're going to switch our focus now from road rage to keeping peace in the friendly skies. Diana Fairchild, an aviation health and safety author and expert witness, was an international flight attendant for 21 years. She is also joining us from Hawaii. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's nice to be here.
You've been an expert witness in several trials, and I'm sure you've heard many stories about air rage. What are a couple examples?
Examples of air rage are most always directed at flight attendants, since the pilots do not leave the flight deck for any reason. Some examples of it: flight attendants have been slapped, struck with wine bottles, punched, pinched, burned with cigarettes, thrown across the plane, bitten, and attempted strangulation. My theory that air rage is triggered by oxygen deprivation on the airplane was first published in 1998 in an article that I wrote for Reuters News Service.
With your theory that it's really a lack of air, how does that work?
The inadequate oxygen to the brain fuels passengers' temper tantrums, which have initially been ignited by prior abrasive incidents at the airport or on board or at home. So, in other words, it's almost like feeling like you're suffocating, and so you become very agitated. I experience it myself because I'm chemically sensitive, and when I'm in an environment where there isn't a lot of fresh air, I am not my most peaceful, most calm, beautiful self that I like to be.
And what are the other conditions that really increase our grumpiness when we travel?
The sardine seating. People are so close together, and people are exhaling in each other's biospace. And then there's alcohol, which is another problem that causes people to lose their inhibitions. And the effects of alcohol at high altitude are more apparent. So there's many other conditions in the plane. So it's the synergy and the combination of all these conditions that cause air rage.
You're making a case that the airlines really hold a lot of the blame for having small seats and low air pressure, but don't passengers bear some responsibility in terms of controlling their own behavior?
That's a really good point, Suzanne, and I believe that if we all carry peace in our hearts, that things won't ignite so easily. I mean, we have to realize that the airplane is a microcosm of humanity, and there are business flyers next to screaming babies. Business people don't want to be there. I mean, there's high techies next to hikers. Maybe they don't want to be near people who are dirty or just out of the woods. And so we all just have to realize that the plane is there for our transportation, and we have to be more adaptable and adjustable, and tolerance and kindness goes a long way to preventing air rage in airplane cabins.
How can people do that? How can we become more tolerant? Are there ways that we can take care of ourselves physically or emotionally before we travel?
You know, how we take care of ourselves, how we treat ourselves in our daily lives is just preparation for when we get into a stressful situation. So if we've taken care of ourselves, if we had a good night's sleep, if we didn't race through the airport, if we didn't bristle at security, you know, we just planned our time. We had plenty of time. We dressed for the airport security area, you know, not wearing metal, you know, all kinds of things we can prepare ourselves. And also to be aware that it is very stressful flying. It's not just air-age individuals and low oxygen. You know, there's about a dozen big stresses, radiation, toxic chemicals, all kinds of things. So if we are going to choose to get on an airplane, my philosophy is inform yourself and do whatever you can to stay in peace, to keep it easy for those sitting around you.
This is Peace Talks. I'm Suzanne Kreider. We're talking with Diana Fairchild, an aviation health and safety expert, about air rage. You know, Diana, when I fly, I'm really sensitive to people who are sitting close to me. For example, I'm really sensitive to people kicking the back of my seat.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens, I'll wait for a while because sometimes it's just people need to settle in. But if it doesn't stop, I'll usually turn around, make eye contact, say hello, and then I'll just ask a question. Did you know you were kicking my seat? 90% of the time, people kind of look horrified, like, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize I was doing that, and they stop. But sometimes people just kick harder. What do you recommend we should do when a passenger gets agitated or upset by another passenger?
Well, the first thing is to see if you can change seats. And passengers are welcome to take any seat in that same section. For instance, if you're flying in economy, you can actually take any seat in economy. You can move. And frequent flyers know that. And a lot of times you'll see right after the door closes, a lot of frequent flyers shifting around, grabbing aisle seats, grabbing rows, whatever. So you can do that too. You know, you can create more space for yourself. I was on a flight the other day in a middle seat, and the man on the window seat had both armrests that he was hogging, and the woman on the aisle seat had both armrests. So I was left there, not even with, you know, able to sit straight-shouldered. And so I looked around, and I thought, well, the woman is being, you know, hit a little bit every time somebody walks by in the aisle, the cart, any passenger. But the man by the window, he's got it made, so he shouldn't be hogging that armrest. So I asked him, hey, you've got two armrests, she has two armrests. Do you think I could have yours because she's having a harder time on the aisle because she has to lean in because people are passing by? And he let me share it with him. He wouldn't get off it entirely. So I haven't entirely figured that out. I didn't enjoy touching him, you know. Mm-hmm. So I actually rolled up my sweater and put it between him and me and kept adjusting myself. And I just, I think you are an expert in communicating with people. I know those brief contact that you and I have, I was so impressed. I felt peaceful every time we talked, and I think it's just developing those skills and having that intention with people in the plane.
But what if there aren't any empty seats to move to? When is it appropriate to enlist the help of a flight attendant?
I wouldn't bother the flight attendant in the beginning of the flight unless it's an urgent matter. If it's a health danger or something like that, you know, bother the flight attendants before takeoff. But otherwise, wait till they're free. And that would be a while after takeoff, particularly if there's a bar and meal service. You know, when all that's done, you know, when I'm bothered by passengers around me, rather than confront them, because people hate to be told what they're doing wrong. People just hate it. Like you found, you know, some of them just kick even harder because they just don't like to be criticized. So here's two suggestions. One is get up and stand by the exit row until things calm down for the flight attendants, or they ask you, why don't you go back to your seat and say, gee, I'd like to, but I'm getting kicked so many times, I'm not sure what to do. You know, try and keep it light. Or get up out of your seat and calm down, go to the bathroom, wash your face, calm down, then come back, and then say to that man or kid or whoever is kicking your seat, I'll give you $5 not to kick my seat for the rest of the flight.
You mentioned earlier that sometimes air rage is precipitated by a prior abrasive incident. You said traveling is very stressful, and I'm thinking about the time that we spend in lines for air travel. And aren't people kind of like all social mammals? There's an innate drive to be first. What suggestions do you have for folks just staying calm in all the lines?
You know, all the lines, and particularly security now, it's very dehumanizing. They make you walk through in your socks or bare feet, and the floor is dirty, and then you have to put your feet back in your shoes. You know, all your clothes are just put in these dirty baskets, and sometimes you're actually mauled. I mean, people are touching your body in private areas. I mean, the whole thing is so dehumanizing. And so I think, again, it has to do with preparing yourself, whatever private religious practice you have, doing it before you fly. And I find that seeing the outcome, seeing yourself arriving safe and looking great helps a lot. Then everything that takes place from here to there kind of gets to be more in the background rather than assaulted here, long line there. I mean, this is the price of it. It's, you know, they say ticket prices have gone down and they've done a great job with, you know, airfares going down, but really the price that we pay in time and energy is way up. And also in our taxes, the price that we're paying to subsidize the airlines. So there's nothing fair going on right now. The thing is, if we want peace, we want it within ourselves, no matter what's going on out there. You know, the price that we pay for getting upset with heart disease and stress, it's just not worth it. So if you do it for yourself, stay peaceful for yourself.
We're coming to the end of our program. If you had 1 minute, Diana, to summarize what passengers can do to assure more peaceful air travel, what would those tips be?
Do unto others as you would like people to do unto you. And then I have this affirmation that I put in all my books that I advise passengers to use while they're traveling. And it goes like this: I count my blessings and do my best. I trust that the Almighty Pilot takes care of the rest.
Where can folks get your book, Jet Smarter?
They should go to flyana.com. That's FLYANA.com. And there are links there. They'll see the book Jet Smarter right on the front page. They can click on it, go to the Jet Smarter page. If they use the link on my website, that will take them to the newest 2004 edition of Jet Smarter.
Diana Fairchild, we'd like to thank you so much for being a guest on Peace Talks today.
It was my pleasure, Suzanne. Thank you.
We'll list resources as well as have other links and excerpts from this program on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. Also at the site, you can send us your comments, including how Peace Talk shows have helped you in some way. Sign up to be in our studio audience or learn how to order CD copies of our programs. That's all at peacetalksradio.com. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated and was recorded in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque. Thanks to our producer and engineer, Paul Ingalls. Music by Yusef Islam and Ali Adelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.